From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. As usual, we have a lot to cover, but let's start with Jimmy Morales, the comedian turned president of Guatemala.
Yeah, Guatemala's interesting, Don, because over the last few weeks, they've done a couple of things that you wouldn't expect a U.S.-friendly right-wing government to do. One of the things that they did about 3 weeks ago now was they abstained in a vote against against Nicaragua in the Organization of American States, where the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights, you know, if you can still call them that, presented what they called their final report. When their investigators actually in Nicaragua had barely even started their investigation. I'm not sure if they had even started their investigative work in Nicaragua, their team of independent investigators. But they don't need proof. They'd already written up their final report based on opposition human rights organizations and opposition news media reports. Right. And so the IACHR presented that farrago to the Permanent Council of the Organization of American States, and as expected, all the US allies voted in favor of accepting the report, except for Guatemala. And then when you look at that, when I was a bit puzzled about that, and I looked at that again, and it became clear that the context of that was the government of Jimmy Morales was extremely resentful of U.S. attempts to set up a kind of parallel legal system, a parallel government in Guatemala, which was, you know, and ironically, that's how Jimmy Morales came to power. The reason he came to power was because the previous president,
right,
Otto Perez, I think his name was,
yes,
was ousted as a result of corruption charges, largely as a result, almost principally as a result, I'd say, of the UN Commission for the Investigation of Corruption and Impunity in Guatemala, which is called CICIG under its Spanish acronym. So CICIG back in those days was part of the structure that helped shoo in Jimmy Morales as a kind of different kind of flavor of the Guatemalan elite to Otto Perez. And Jimmy Morales took power, and then he found himself subject to the same kind of harassment.
Right.
As I think is a legitimate word to use.
Yeah, and it only took a month, you know, because he took it. You know, the statement came January, I think February of this year, against the findings against Venezuela, and in March, the IACHR released a report on Guatemala.
Right. So the situation there is that there's a same as in the United States, there are continuing internecine turf wars between different sectors of the elite, in this case in a much smaller country, obviously. But basically the pattern's the same as in the United States. You have this kind of turf war,
right,
between different sections of the elite, sections that are more aligned with United States interests, sections that are only aligned with United States interests insofar as that's good for them, like,
right,
Jimmy Morales and his backers, who are largely associated with the Guatemalan military. And so you have this curious situation where this right-wing government is, in fact, legitimately claiming that the CICIG body, this anti-corruption UN body, is being manipulated by the United States, creating a parallel, effectively a parallel structure that challenges the institutional legitimacy of Guatemala. And that's true.
Right.
You know, and so you have this curious situation where this right-wing government is actually telling the truth. you know, which is
right. Yep.
Perhaps not a first in Latin America, but it's certainly unusual, you know. Right. And so they have taken this line, and that also reflects some, in part, that just reflects the internal reality in Guatemala, where there's a large middle class lobby that is anti-corruption, but that is still kind of, it's a bit like the human rights, the way the human rights motif is used to manipulate
right.
liberal and progressive opinion in the United States.
Right.
You know, and they, yep. whenever a country becomes a target for regime change, the first item that comes up in the, on the psychological warfare agenda in the corporate media is the human rights motif.
Right, the second is corruption. And corruption is the second one. And the both are, you know, corruption more so, but both are, you know, non-ideological complaints, although they might come dressed as, you know, being of one or another ideological hue. They're essentially non-ideological. They allege a pattern of, you know, fact pattern of wrongdoing that, you know, among a certain group inside the political class, and that authorizes or enables or sanctifies some extra legal or extrajudicial action to remove or negate those players.
Yeah, and in the case of what United States policy in the region, and although it's a kind of a very, you know, well-worn cliche, I mean, what you need to look at in the case of U.S. policy in the region is what are the corporate interests involved? And if you look at what's going on in Guatemala, there's obviously a kind of struggle between those parts of the Guatemalan elite that want to facilitate U.S. corporate interests and other foreign corporate interests, and the kind of nationalist right-wing part of the Guatemalan elite that wants to defend their own share of the pie, right? And so, and you can see that across the region. You see it in Brazil. Why did Eduardo da Cunha get locked up, for example, who was the right-wing president of the lower house in Brazil, who facilitated the coup against Dilma Rousseff and subsequently facilitated, along with the usurper president, was it Michel Temer, the abuse of the judicial system against to prevent the candidacy of Lula da Silva, and why is he in jail? Presumably, and this is just speculation on my part, but presumably because although he was an extreme right winger, who to some extent facilitated the U.S. agenda, the political agenda, he seems to have been unwilling to facilitate the corporate agenda of a wholesale selling off of Brazil's patrimony to U.S. corporate elites, which is what is happening under Temer and what is likely to continue to happen should a right winger get elected in the elections in October in Brazil.
Assuming he doesn't get stabbed.
Sorry, Don.
Assuming that particular right winger doesn't get stabbed.
Well, yeah, and
what
was that all about? You know, and that incident in which the right wing favorite, when I say that, I mean the most likely right wing politician to win the Brazilian election. He was stabbed in a very strange incident, apparently by somebody who believed they were acting on the word of God.
Right.
So, you know, and how seriously does one take that? It's impossible to know.
Right.
So then looking again, taking that corruption issue that has been the motif around which the United States has tried to manipulate politics in Guatemala. And staying in the Central American region just for a moment, the reason that that's interesting and that the way the dynamic that's playing out is interesting is because that definitely has implications for what the United States can expect to achieve if it decides to go ahead and implement increasingly severe economic sanctions against Nicaragua, which seems likely. Now, my thing about that is that it's different now. In the 1980s, they were able to get away with those sanctions because Nicaragua wasn't as integrated into Central American economic life as it is now in regional terms. But you saw, we all saw what happened when around 400 truckers from across the region were held hostage by the opposition gangs, the violent opposition gangs here, during the crisis between April and July of this year. The opposition gangs held hostage around 400 truckers who were responsible for something around 250 of those big articulated trucks that are the actual lifeblood of trade throughout Central America in this region. And so when that happened, what was the result? And after about a month of that, you had the respective ambassadors of the Central American countries complaining to the mediating bishops, who are supposed to be mediating the crisis here in Nicaragua, about that. And they explicitly stated the damage that that was doing to their own economies.
Right.
Okay? So things are different now. And then if the United States attacks the Nicaraguan economy, there'll be knock-on effects in the local regional economy that they have no control over.
Right.
And so maybe they don't care. I mean, they certainly don't care about migrants. They, you know, and some people argue that the United States won't go hell for leather for economic sanctions against Nicaragua because they don't want to worsen the migrant crisis. Well, that seems to me completely stupid.
Right.
What? The corporate elite suddenly developed a conscience about ordinary people in Central America.
Not only
that's
that.
Ridiculous. So, but what is likely to put a brake on U.S. attempts to damage the region is precisely this kind of nationalist feeling that is of which Jimmy Morales' decision to refuse to accept the renewal of the CICIG, UN anti-corruption body. And that is an expression of the kind of Central American reality that now exists. And if you were to deliberately set out to damage the Central American economy, what you'd do is target Nicaragua. Because that is the kind of, it's where everything goes to and fro between the rest of the region.
Right.
And the rest of the region, and the rest of the region is Nicaragua's biggest trading partner. So they are the ones that are going to be hit hard by any sanctions against Nicaragua imposed by the U.S. government.
Right.
Let's see how that pans out. Will it make a difference? I don't know. But things are definitely different now in those terms. And so then when looking at that, and that makes me think about the larger regional reality, which seems to me, and I'd be interested to know what this looks like from your point of view, Don, because to me what it looks like is, we talked about this back in 2015, just after the Argentinian elections, when Mauricio Macri was elected by barely 2% of the vote. He just squeaked through. Why did he squeak through? Because, as usual, the Social Democrats held the door open for him.
Right.
This guy, Sergio Massa, who's nominally a Peronist, but he has this strong Social Democrat wing, and they decided to divide the opposition votes, and that opened the door for Macri.
And we saw that actually in the Congress there as well. After Macri got elected, it seemed at first that the left had a sizable majority, but we found out that some of those people were actually voting with Macri's people as soon as they convened.
And that was Sergio Massa. And now what's happening? Now Sergio Massa is desperately trying to distance himself from what he made possible. And Sergio Massa and his Social Democrats are the people that shooed in Macri and shooed in everything that Macri represented, which is economic crisis. And they immediately implemented, just as we said back then, you don't even need to be an amoeba with half a brain to be able to work out what going to happen with the election of Mauricio Macri? He implemented neoliberal policies, sold out the country's national interest to the vulture funds on Wall Street, brought in, he's now bringing in the army to carry out domestic policing duties. He's reached an agreement with the United States military so that they can have a base in Argentina. Everything that you associate with the right-wing dictatorship from 1976 to 1983, or whatever the actual dates were, and Mauricio Macri is bringing back. And he's also brought back with a vengeance the economic crisis of 1999, 2000,
right. 2001. Right, exactly. That was, we had said back when Macri got elected, and essentially then, it was only after he was elected, laid out, you know, indicated where he was headed with the economic program, that this was going to lead to exactly the crisis that led to Nestor Kirchner coming to power and repairing and, you know, revitalizing the economy, which continued with Cristina's administration. And what happened? Macri came in. They basically have precipitated a crisis, and the country's almost in the same position that it was back then, with the IMF even saying
it's worse now. Yeah. It's much worse now.
And it took 3 years.
It doesn't look like it on the surface, but it's actually, and if you look at the figures, and the national debt's worse, and the economy is in a much worse state, and it's just, and then when you look at that, and let's put that in the wider context along with the Central American stuff. And if you put all that in the wider context and look at what's happening in Brazil, and what's happening is that the United States corporate elites, who currently have a kind of sales representative selling some flavor of their interests, Donald Trump, but what they are after in Latin America, they know that time is running out for them. They've lost Eurasia. They're trying to consolidate themselves in Latin America, but they can't do it in a democratic way on the basis of the policies that the governments they put into power are putting into place. So you see in Brazil a frantic rush to sell off the public sector resources,
right,
to allow the United States military to participate in Brazilian security policy and even in their aerospace policy, because there's this very important space station, which is the only space station owned by a sovereign Latin American country in Brazil. And they launch rockets into space. And the United States is taking steps to make sure that they have control of that base. And so in every sense, Brazil's sovereignty and its national patrimony is being sold off to the corporate elites and that will control those resources directly, and to the U.S. military, which is itself controlled by the corporate elites, you know, the armaments industry and so on. Yeah. And so what's going on is that the United States is in a race against time to extract every last bit of Latin American resources that are worth anything in the period of time that they have left before they stop being a global superpower.
Yeah.
And that's how long will that take? Will it take 3 years? Will it take 5 years? Will it take 10 years? Nobody knows, but that's what's going to happen. Yeah. And the corporate elites know that's what's going to happen. And so that's why they're hammering Latin America and sticking their kind of claws into it to extract as much of Latin America's resources as they can over the next 2 or 3 years, and what does that mean in political terms? How does that translate in political terms into events in Argentina? Well, what you've got there is you've got Sergio Massa trying to displace Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner with the assistance of the extreme right wing and their corrupt judiciary. So he's hoping to become the kind of pseudo-progressive front-runner in Argentina who will then take over from Mauricio Macri. But what will be his role as a social democrat? His role as a social democrat will be to extend the period of resource extraction, right, available to U.S. and other corporate elites.
Right.
That You know, that is the political reality in Argentina. And if you look at what's going on in Brazil, you have the same kind of process.
Right.
That guy who was stabbed, not seriously injured, who's the main right-wing front-runner for the Brazilian presidency, what is going to be his role should he win? The same, to facilitate continued extraction of Brazilian resources for U.S. and other foreign elites. And you can see, and why are we likely to see a tremendous offensive against the re-election of Evo Morales in Brazil? And why do we see in Peru this corruption crisis, another crisis around the corruption motif? We see it because the United States, there will be an attack against Evo Morales in Bolivia. But what's going on there is that Peru and Bolivia have the best relations that they've ever had since the 19th century, is what Evo Morales described the situation as over the weekend. And why is that? You have a right-wing government in Peru. Why are they developing good relations with what in theory should be a target country for them, given the fact that they're a US ally? Well, they're not just a US ally. Peru has a strong projection into the Pacific, across to Asia, as does Bolivia. And they are beneficiaries of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative.
Right.
Because as we've discussed in program after program, they are the ones that are developing and promoting the transcontinental railway that will transform trade and economic realities in South America and shift the balance away from dependence on the North and the United States and towards a much closer relationship, a win-win relationship, not a dependency relationship, but a win-win relationship,
right,
both sides benefit, with China. That's what that is all about. And that is why you can see this attack developing against manipulating the corruption motif in Peru. And that is why we will see an all-out offensive against Bolivia when the elections come around next, I think it's next year, in the same way that we've seen an assault on Nicaragua to try and overthrow the government here and attempt regime change, as they've done in Venezuela. And where else have they done it? Ecuador, of course.
Right.
We could just, there's so much to talk about, Don.
Right.
And just look at Ecuador in that context.
They elected a guy to do something, and to, you know, to follow a particular line. That's what he said he was doing. That's his whole career up to that point. He was groomed for the position to continue the work that been well underway for how many terms the previous president
two,
right? So he was supposed to be like the next term following the same program. The minute he gets in, he turns face. Now he's withdrawing from ALBA. Go through this stuff. But he's, you know, Julian Assange has to worry, for example.
Yeah, and when Lenin Moreno took over in Ecuador, it was actually apparent in the second part of the presidential campaign, because he only won on the second round, and he didn't win by a very big margin either. But in the same way that in Argentina the right wing mounted a successful campaign, claiming that the economic slowdown was due to progressive policies there. And that's what the right wing did in Ecuador. And so they intimidated somebody who's an extremely weak individual in moral terms, Lenin Moreno. They intimidated him into doing a turnabout and essentially betraying the platform on which he was in theory elected. And so he began instituting austerity. He set about to, in an unconstitutional way, in the same way that the judicial and legal system and constitutional system have been abused in Brazil and Argentina, he abused Ecuador's constitutional arrangements to he held a referendum that should have been ratified by the Supreme Court, but never was. So essentially, everything that he's done since then has been illegal, in strict constitutional terms. But he's rigged the courts. He's got this provisional transitional body, to which he has nominated, via his proxies, people that do what he says. And essentially what he asked people to do is what the right wing tell him to do. So now he's instituting austerity policies because his economic formula has failed to do what he said it would do. He's threatening to, or he hasn't actually threatened to, but all the signs are in as many words. But all the signs are he's going to hand Assange over to the United Kingdom authorities, which is essentially a long prison sentence in the United States for Julian Assange. He's withdrawn from the progressive ALBA bloc of countries, and that means that he's almost certainly going to start attacking Venezuela in the Organization of American States, something which to date he has refrained from doing. But that's just the next step. And he's also withdrawn from UNASUR, which is the Union of South American Nations, which is the main body in South America that has fomented a kind of a non-ideological integration. But now the right wing have politicized that. Colombia has announced its withdrawal from UNASUR. Right. Ecuador is likely shortly to withdraw from UNASUR. And so you have this whole series of decisions, and the latest is that the government of Lenin Moreno seems unwilling to contest a judgment by what's called the permanent tribunal for arbitration, that although it's based in The Hague, it doesn't have anything like the prestige and authority of the International Court of Justice.
Right.
But this permanent arbitration tribunal has just issued a judgment in favor of Chevron, the big oil company, which the Ecuadorian government under Rafael Correa had sued for damages by Texaco over many years.
Right.
And then Chevron subsequently took over Texaco, right?
Right.
And Chevron are arguing that they're not liable.
Right.
But the Ecuadorian government has argued that, of course, they're liable because they took over the company that was responsible for $1 billion worth of pollution.
Of damage.
Now,
here's the big pile of money that you made destroying our country. Now you own it. Oh, so the people who suffered have no claim to it because it switched owners.
Right, yeah, and the Ecuadorian government should be challenging that.
Right.
They should be appealing it.
But they're not.
They should be doing everything possible at an international level, and they should even do what China did.
Right.
In a similar, do you remember that judgment that the same tribunal issued against China in the South China Sea? Well, what did China do? They just ignored it.
Right.
Well, Ecuador could do the same.
That's right.
You know? And so, but they're not. And apparently what they're saying is that they're now going to have to sue Rafael Correa to get back the money that they're going to pay to Chevron.
Mm-mm-mm.
Right? So I mean, that's amazing. You know, that just shows you the extent as far as one can see, Lenin Moreno's days are numbered, because his credibility, his popularity ratings in Ecuador haven't yet reached the same level as Mauricio Macri, but they soon will.
Yeah, they're headed south for sure. We got about a minute left. And so which of these other items do you want to give us a very quick treatment of?
Well, I mean, the encouraging thing is in Venezuela, where they seem to, however, their economic reform measures, especially their currency reform measures, are likely to pan out over the next 2 or 3 years. They seem to have taken a decisive series of steps that are going to transform their economy and make them much less vulnerable to the kinds of sanctions and pressure through economic and financial structures dominated by the United States financial elites and their allies in Western Europe.
Right.
And that's extremely positive for the region.
Yeah,
I mean, it may not work
is.
Out 100% as people hope, but it's certainly a beacon of hope.
Yep, it's a start for sure. And Tony, thank you very much. We'll speak with you next week, and maybe we can work that a little more when we get to it next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Good to talk to you.
The same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.